frowning into space. Outside, the cars are whizzing by endlessly. I can hear the steady little whine my tape recorder makes, but it all seems a little too brittle, too glossy, just a cheap patina over a darker world, a real world where nightmares happen. "She was such a pretty girl," Stella Haran resumes, lighting another cigarette. "I've seen some high school pictures of her in that horrible fuzzy black and white photo on the cover of Newsweek. I look at them and all I can think is, dear God, where did she go? What did that woman do to her?" Then I feel sick and sorry. She was so pretty, with pink cheeks and bright brown eyes and her hair the shade of blonde you know will darken and get mousy. Sweet is the only word that fits. Sweet and bright and innocent. Her mother's sickness hadn't touched her very deeply, not then. I kind of started up awake and tried to smile. It was hard to think what to do. I was logy from the sun and my mind felt sticky and slow. I said, "Hi." She was wearing a little yellow dress, sort of cute, but awfully long for a little girl in the summer. Came down to her shins. She didn't smile back. She just pointed and said, "What are those?" I looked down and saw that my top had slipped while I was asleep, so I fixed it and said, "Those are my breasts, Carrie." Then she said, very solemnly, "I wish I had some." I said, "You have to wait, Carrie. You won't start to get them for another, 8 or 9 years. "No, I won't," she said. "Mama says good girls don't." She looked strange for a little girl, half sad and half self-righteous. I could hardly believe it, and the first thing that popped into my mind also popped right out of my mouth. I said, "Well, I'm a good girl, and doesn't your mother have breasts?" She lowered her head and said something so softly I couldn't hear it. When I asked her to repeat it, she looked at me defiantly and said that her mama had been bad when she made her, and that was why she had them. She called them dirty pillows, as if it was all one word. I couldn't believe it. I was just dumbfounded. There was nothing at all I could think to say. We just stared at each other, and what I wanted to do was grab that sad little scrap of a girl and run away with her. And that was when Margaret White came out of her back door and saw us. For a minute, she just goggled as if she couldn't believe it. Then she opened her mouth and whooped. That's the ugliest sound I've ever heard in my life. It was like the noise a bull alligator would make in a swamp. She just whooped. Rage. Complete, insane rage. Her face went just as red as the side of a fire truck, and she curled her hands into fists and whooped at the sky. She was shaking all over. I thought she was having a stroke. Her face was all scrunched up, and it was a gargoyle's face. I thought Carrie was going to faint or die on the spot. She sucked in all her breath, and that little face went a cottage cheesy color. Her mother yelled, "Carrie!" I jumped up and yelled back, "Don't you yell at her that way. You ought to be ashamed." Something stupid like that, I don't remember. Carrie started to go back, and then she stopped, and then she started again, and just before she crossed over from our lawn to there, she looked back at me, and there was a look. Oh, dreadful, I can't say it. Wanting and hating and fearing and misery. As if life itself had fallen on her like stones. All at the age of 3. My mother came out on the back stoop, and her face just crumpled when she saw the child. And Margaret, oh, she was screaming things about sluts and strumpets and the sins of the fathers being visited even unto the 7th generation. My tongue felt like a little dried-up plant. For just a second, Carrie stood swaying back and forth between the 2 yards, and then Margaret White looked upward, and I swear, sweet Jesus, that woman bayed at the sky. And then she started to hurt herself. scourge herself. She was clawing at her neck and cheeks, making red marks and scratches. She tore her dress. Carrie screamed out, "Mama!" and ran to her. Mrs. White kind of squatted like a frog, and her arms swooped wide open. I thought she was going to crush her, and I screamed. The woman was grinning. Grinning and drooling right down her chin. Oh, I was sick. Jesus, I was so sick. She gathered her up and they went in. I turned off my radio and I could hear her. Some of the words, but not all. You didn't have to hear all the words to know what was going on. Praying and sobbing and screeching. Crazy sounds. Margaret telling the little girl to get herself into her closet and pray. The little girl crying and screaming that she was sorry. She forgot. Then nothing. And my mother and I just looked at each other. I never saw Mom look so bad. Not even when Dad died. She said, "The child." And that was all. We went inside. She gets up and goes to the window, a pretty woman in a yellow no-back sundress. "It's almost like living it all over again, you know," she says, not turning around. I'm all riled up inside again. She laughs a little and cradles her elbows in her palms. Oh, she was so pretty. You'd never know from those pictures. Cars go by outside. Back and forth, and I sit and wait for her to go on. She reminds me of a pole vaulter eyeing the bar and wondering if it's set too high. My mother brewed a scotch tea, strong, with milk, the way she used to when I was tomboying around and someone would push me in the nettle patch or I'd fall off my bicycle. It was awful, but we drank it anyway, sitting across from each other in the kitchen nook. She was in some old house dress with the hem falling down and back, and I was in my Whore of Babylon two-piece swimsuit. I wanted to cry, but it was too real to cry about, not like the movies. Once when I was in New York, I saw an old drunk leading a little girl in a blue dress by the hand. The girl had cried herself into a bloody nose. The drunk had gored her and his neck looked like an inner tube. There was a red bump in the middle of his forehead and a long white string on the blue serge jacket he was wearing. Everyone kept going and coming because if you did, then pretty soon you wouldn't see them anymore. That was real, too. I wanted to tell my mother that, and I was just opening my mouth to say it when the other thing happened. The thing you want to hear about, I guess. There was a big thump outside that made the glasses rattle in the china cabinet. It was a feeling as well as a sound. Thick and solid, as if someone had just pushed an iron safe off the roof. She lights a new cigarette and begins to puff rapidly. I went to the window and looked out, but I couldn't see anything. Then, when I was getting ready to turn around, something else fell. The sun glittered on it. I thought it was a big glass globe for a second. Then it hit the edge of the White's roof and shattered, and it wasn't glass at all. It was a big chunk of ice. I was going to turn around and tell Mom, and that's when they started to fall all at once, in a shower. They were falling on the White's roof, on the back and front lawn, on the outside door to their cellar. That was the sheet tin bulkhead, and when the first one hit, it made a huge bong noise, like a church bell. My mother and I both screamed. We were clutching each other like a couple of girls in a thunderstorm. Then it stopped. There was no sound at all from their house. You could see the water from the melting ice trickling down their slate shingles in the sunshine. A great big hunk of ice was stuck in the angle of the roof in their little chimney. The light on it was so bright that my eyes hurt to look at it. My mother started to ask me if it was over, and then Margaret screamed. The sound came to us very clearly. In a way, it was worse than before, because there was terror in this one. Then there were clanging, banging sounds as if she was throwing every pot and pan in the house at the girl. The back door slammed open and slammed closed. No one came out. More screams. Mom said for me to call the police, but I couldn't move. I was stuck to the spot. Mr. Kirk and his wife Virginia came out on their lawn to look. The Smiths, too. Pretty soon, everyone on the street that was home had come out, even old Mrs. Warwick from up the block, and she was deaf in one ear. Things started to crash and tinkle and break. Bottles, glasses, I don't know what all, and then the side window broke open and the kitchen table fell halfway through. With God as my witness, it was a big mahogany thing, and it took the screen with it, and it must have weighed 300 pounds. How could a woman, even a big woman, throw that? I ask her if she is implying something. I'm only telling you, she insists, suddenly distraught. I'm not asking you to believe. She seems to catch her breath and then goes on flatly. There was nothing for maybe 5 minutes. Water was dripping out of the gutters over there, and there was ice all over the White's lawn. It was melting fast. She gives a short, chopping laugh and butts her cigarette. Why not? It was August. She wanders aimlessly back toward the sofa, then veers away. Then the stones, right out of the blue, blue sky, whistling and screaming like bombs. My mother cried out, "What in the name of God?" and put her hands over her head. But I couldn't move. I watched it all, and I couldn't move. Didn't matter anyway. They only fell on the White's property. One of them hit a downspout and knocked it onto the lawn. Others punched holes right through the roof and into the attic. The roof made a big cracking sound each time one hit, and puffs of dust would squirt up. The ones that hit the ground made everything vibrate. You could feel them hitting in your feet. Our china was tinkling, and the fancy Welsh dresser was shaking, and Mom's teacup fell on the floor and broke. They made big pits in the White's back lawn when they struck. Craters. Mrs. White hired a junk man from across town to cart them away, and Jerry Smith from up the street paid him $1 to let him chip a piece off one. He took it to BU, and they looked at it and said it was ordinary granite. One of the last ones hit a little table they had in their backyard and smashed it to pieces. But nothing, nothing that wasn't on their property was hit. She stops and turns from the window to look at me, and her face is haggard from remembering all that. One hand plays forgetfully with her casually stylish shag haircut. Not much of it got into the local paper. By the time Billy Harris came around, he reported the Chamberlain News. She had already gotten the roof fixed, and when people told him the stones had gone right through it, I think he thought we were all pulling his leg. Nobody wants to believe it. Not even now. You and all the people who'll read what you write will wish they could laugh it off and call me just another nut who's been out here in the sun too long. But it happened. There were lots of people on the block who saw it happen, and it was just as real as that drunk leading the little girl with the bloody nose. And now there's this other thing. No one can laugh that off either. Too many people are dead. And it's not just on the White's property anymore. She smiles, but there's not a drop of humor in it. She says, Ralph White was insured, and Margaret got a lot of money when he died. Double indemnity. He left the house insured, too, but she never got a penny of that. The damage was caused by an act of God. Poetic justice, huh? She laughs a little. But there's no humor in that either. Found written repeatedly on one page of a Ewan Consolidated High School notebook owned by Carrie White. Everybody's guessed that baby can't be blessed till she finally sees that she's like all the rest. Carrie went into the house and closed the door behind her. Bright daylight disappeared and was replaced by brown shadows, coolness, and the oppressive smell of talcum powder. The only sound was the ticking of the Black Forest cuckoo clock in the living room. Mama had gotten the cuckoo clock with green stamps. Once, in the sixth grade, Carrie had set out to ask Mama if green stamps weren't sinful, but her nerve had failed her. She walked up the hall and put her coat in the closet. A luminous picture above the coat hooks limned a ghostly Jesus hovering grimly over a family seated at the kitchen table. Beneath was the caption, also luminous, "The Unseen Guest." She went into the living room and stood in the middle of the faded, starting to be threadbare rug. She closed her eyes and watched the little dots flash by in the darkness. Her headache thumped queasily behind her temples. Alone. Mama worked on the speed ironer and folder down at the Blue Ribbon Laundry in Chamberlain Center. She had worked there since Carrie was 5, when the compensation in insurance that had resulted from her father's accident had begun to run out. Her hours were from 7:30 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. The laundry was godless. Mama had told her so many times. The foreman, Mr. Elton Mott, was especially godless. Mama said that Satan had reserved a special blue corner of hell for Elt, as he was called at the Blue Ribbon. Alone. She opened her eyes. The living room contained 2 chairs with straight backs. There was a sewing table with a light where Carrie sometimes made dresses in the evening while Mama tatted doilies and talked about the coming. The Black Forest cuckoo clock was on the far wall. There were many religious pictures, but the one Carrie liked best was on the wall above her chair. It was Jesus leading lambs on a hill that was as green and smooth as the Riverside Golf Course. The others were not as tranquil. Jesus turning the money changers from the temple. Moses throwing the tablets down upon the worshippers of the golden calf. Thomas the doubter putting his hand in Christ's wounded side. Oh, the horrified fascination of that one, and the nightmares it had given her as a girl. Noah's Ark floating above the agonized, drowning sinners. Lot and his family fleeing the great burning of Sodom and Gomorrah. On a small deal table there were a lamp and a stack of tracts. The top pamphlet showed a sinner. His spiritual status was obvious from the agonized expression on his face, trying to crawl beneath a large boulder. The title blared, "Neither shall the rock hide him on that day." But the room was actually dominated by a huge plaster crucifix on the far wall, fully 4 feet high. Mama had mail-ordered it special from St. Louis. The Jesus impaled upon it was frozen in a grotesque, muscle-straining rictus of pain, mouth drawn down in a groaning curve. His crown of thorns bled scarlet streams down temples and forehead. The eyes were turned up in a medieval expression of slanted agony. Both hands were also drenched with blood, and the feet were nailed to a small plaster platform. This corpus had also given Carrie endless nightmares in which the mutilated Christ chased her through dream corridors, holding a mallet and nails, begging her to take up her cross and follow him. Just lately, these dreams had evolved into something less understandable, but more sinister. The object did not seem to be murder, but something even more awful. Alone. The pain in her legs and belly and privates had drained away a little. She no longer thought she was bleeding to death. The word was menstruation, and all at once it seemed logical and inevitable. It was her time of the month. She giggled a strange, affrighted giggle in the solemn stillness of the living room. It sounded like a quiz show. "You, too, can win an all-expenses-paid trip to Bermuda on time of the month." Like the memory of the stones, the knowledge of menstruation seemed always to have been there, blocked but waiting. She turned and walked heavily upstairs. The bathroom had a wooden floor that had been scrubbed nearly white. Cleanliness is next to godliness. And a tub on claw feet. Rust stains dripped down the porcelain below the chrome spout, and there was no shower attachment. Mama said showers were sinful. Carrie went in, opened the towel cabinet, and began to hunt purposely but carefully, not leaving anything out of place. Mama's eyes were sharp. The blue box was in the very back, behind the old towels they didn't use anymore. There was a fuzzily silhouetted woman in a long, filmy gown on the side. She took one of the napkins out and looked at it curiously. She had blotted the lipstick she snuck into her purse quite openly with these, once on a street corner. Now she remembered, or imagined she did, quizzical, shocked looks. Her face flamed. They had told her. The flush faded to a milky anger. She went into her tiny bedroom. There were many more religious pictures here, but there were more lambs and fewer scenes of righteous wrath. A UN pennant was tacked over her dresser. On the dresser itself was a Bible and a plastic Jesus that glowed in the dark. She undressed, first her blouse, then her hateful knee-length skirt, her slip, her girdle, her petty pants, her garter belt, her stockings. She looked at the pile of heavy clothes, their buttons and rubber, with an expression of fierce wretchedness. In the school library there was a stack of back issues of 17, and often she leafed through them, pasting an expression of idiotic casualness on her face. The models looked so easy and smooth in their short, kicky skirts, pantyhose, and frilly underwear with patterns on them. Of course, easy was one of Mama's pet words. She knew what Mama would say, oh, no question, to describe them. And it would make her dreadfully self-conscious. She knew that. Naked, evil, blackened with the sin of exhibitionism, the breeze blowing lewdly up the backs of her legs, inciting lust. And she knew that they would know how she felt. They always did. They would embarrass her somehow, push her savagely back down into clowndom. It was their way. She could, she knew she could be. What? In another place. She was thick through the waist, only because sometimes she felt so miserable, empty, bored, that the only way to fill that gaping, whistling hole was to eat and eat and eat. But she was not that thick through the middle. Her body chemistry would not allow her to go beyond a certain point. And she thought her legs were actually pretty, almost as pretty as Sue Snell's or Vicky Hanscom's. She could be, what, could stop the chocolates and her pimples would go down. They always did. She could fix her hair, buy pantyhose and blue and green tights, make little skirts and dresses from Butterick and Simplicity patterns. The price of a bus ticket, a train ticket, she could be, could be. Alive. She unsnapped her heavy cotton bra and let it fall. Her breasts were milk white, upright and smooth. The nipples were a light coffee color. She ran her hands over them and a little shiver went through her. Evil. Bad. Oh, it was. Mama had told her there was something. The something was dangerous, ancient, unutterably evil. It could make you feeble. Watch, Mama said. It comes at night. It will make you think of the evil that goes on in parking lots and roadhouses. But though this was only 9:20 in the morning, Carrie thought that the something had come to her. She ran her hands over her breasts. Dirty pillows, again. And the skin was cool, but the nipples were hot and hard, and when she tweaked one, it made her feel weak and dissolving. Yes, this was the something. Her underpants were spotted with blood. Suddenly she felt that she must burst into tears, scream, or rip the something out of her body, whole and beating, crush it, kill it. The napkin Miss Desjardins had fixed was already wilting, and she changed it carefully, knowing how bad she was, how bad they were, how she hated them and herself. Only Mama was good. Mama had battled the black man and had vanquished him. Carrie had seen it happen in a dream. Mama had driven him out the front door with a broom, and the black man had fled up Carlin Street into the night, his cloven feet striking red sparks from the cement. Her mama had torn the something out of herself and was pure. Carrie hated her. She caught a glimpse of her own face in the tiny mirror she had hung on the back of the door, a mirror with a cheap green plastic rim, good only for combing hair by. She hated her face, her dull, stupid, bovine face, the vapid eyes, the red, shiny pimples, the nests of blackheads. She hated her face most of all. The reflection was suddenly split by a jagged, silvery crack. The mirror fell on the floor and shattered at her feet, leaving only the plastic ring to stare at her like a blinded eye. From Ogilvie's Dictionary of Psychic Phenomena, telekinesis is the ability to move objects or to cause changes in objects by force of the mind. The phenomenon has most reliably been reported in times of crisis or in stress situations when automobiles have been levitated from pinned bodies or debris from collapsed buildings, etc. The phenomenon is often confused with the work of poltergeists, which are playful spirits. It should be noted that poltergeists are astral beings of questionable reality, while telekinesis is thought to be an empiric function of the mind, possibly electrochemical in nature. When they had finished making love, as she slowly put her clothes in order in the back seat of Tommy Ross's 1963 Ford, Sue Snell found her thoughts turning back to Carrie White. It was Friday night, and Tommy, who was looking pensively out the back window with his pants still down around his ankles, the effect was comic but oddly endearing, had taken her bowling. That, of course, was a mutually accepted excuse. Fornication had been on their minds from the word go. She had been going out more or less steadily with Tommy ever since October. It was now May, and they had been lovers for only 2 weeks. 7 times, she amended. Tonight had been the 7th. There had been no fireworks yet, no bands playing Stars and Stripes Forever, but it had gotten a little better. The first time it hurt like hell. Her girlfriends, Helen Shires and Jean Gault, had both done it, and they both assured her that it only hurt for a minute, like getting a shot of penicillin, and then it was roses. But for Sue, the first time had been like being reamed out with a hoe handle. Tommy had confessed to her since, with a grin, that he had gotten the rubber on wrong, too. Tonight was only the second time she had begun to feel something like pleasure, and then it was over. Tommy had held out for as long as he could, but then it was just over. It seemed like an awful lot of rubbing for a little warmth. In the aftermath, she felt low and melancholy, and her thoughts turned to Carrie in this light. A wave of remorse caught her with all emotional guards down, and when Tommy turned back from the view of Brickyard Hill, she was crying. "Hey," he said, alarmed. "Oh, hey." He held her clumsily. "It's all right," she said, still weeping. "It's not you. I did a not-so-good thing today. I was just thinking of it." "What?" He patted the back of her neck gently. So she found herself launching into the story of that morning's incident, hardly believing it was herself she was listening to. Facing the thing frankly, she realized the main reason she had allowed Tommy to have her was because she was in love. Infatuation? Didn't matter, results were the same with him, and now to put herself in this position? cohort in a nasty shower room joke was hardly the approved method to hook a fella. And Tommy was, of course, popular. As someone who had been popular herself all her life, it had almost seemed written that she would meet and fall in love with someone as popular as she. They were almost certain to be voted king and queen of the high school spring ball, and the senior class had already voted them class couple for the yearbook. They had become a fixed star in the shifting firmament of the high school's relationships. The acknowledged Romeo and Juliet, and she knew with sudden hatefulness that there was one couple like them in every white suburban high school in America. And having something she had always longed for, a sense of place, of security, of status, she found that it carried uneasiness with it, like a darker sister. It was not the way she had conceived it. There were dark things lumbering around their warm circle of light. The idea that she had let him fuck her. Do you have to say it that way? Yes, this time I do. Simply because he was popular, for instance. The fact that they fit together walking, or that she could look at their reflection in a store window and think, there goes a handsome couple. She was quite sure, or only hopeful, that she wasn't that weak, not that liable to fall docilely into the complacent expectations of parents, friends, and even herself. But now there was this shower thing where she had gone along and pitched in with high savage glee. The word she was avoiding was expressed to conform in the infinitive, and it conjured up miserable images of hair rollers, long afternoons in front of the ironing board, in front of the soap operas while hubby was off busting heavies in an anonymous office, of joining the PTA and then the country club when their income moved into five figures, of pills in circular yellow cases without number to insure against having to move out of the missus sizes before it became absolutely necessary, and against the intrusion of repulsive little strangers who shat in their pants and screamed for help at 2 in the morning, of fighting with desperate decorum to keep the niggers out of clean corners, standing shoulder to shoulder with Terry Smith, Miss Potato Blossom of 1975, and Vicki Jones, Vice President of the Women's League, armed with signs and petitions and sweet, slightly desperate smiles. Carrie. It was that goddamn Carrie. This was her fault. Perhaps before today she had heard distant circling footfalls around their lighted place. But tonight, hearing her own sordid, crummy story, she saw the actual silhouettes of all these things. And yellow eyes that glowed like flashlights in the dark. She had already bought her prom gown. It was blue. It was beautiful. You're right, he said when she was done. Bad news. Doesn't sound a bit like you. His face was grave, and she felt a cool slice of terror. Then he smiled. He had a very jolly smile, and the darkness retreated a bit. I kicked a kid in the slats once when he was knocked out. Did I ever tell you about that? She shook her head. Yeah. He rubbed his nose reminiscently, and his cheek gave a small tick, the way it had when he made his confession about getting the rubber wrong the first time. The kid's name was Danny Patrick. He beat the living shit out of me once when we were in the 6th grade. I hated him, but I was scared too. I was laying for him. You know how that is. She didn't, but she nodded anyway. Anyway, he finally picked on the wrong kid a year or so later. Pete Tabor. He was just a little guy, but he had lots of muscle. Danny got on him about something, and finally Peter just rose up righteous and beat the shit out of him. That was on the playground of the old Kennedy Junior High. Danny fell down and hit his head and went out cold. Everybody ran. We thought he might be dead. I ran away too, but first I gave him a good kick in the ribs. Felt really bad about it afterward. You gonna apologize to her? It caught Sue flat-footed, and all she could do was clench weakly. Did you? Huh? Hell no, I had better things to do than spend my time in traction. But there's a big difference, Susie. There is? It's not seventh grade anymore, and I had some kind of reason, even if it was a piss-poor reason. What did that sad, silly bitch ever do to you? She didn't answer because she couldn't. She'd never passed more than 100 words with Carrie in her whole life, and 36 or so had come today. Phys Ed was the only class they'd had in common since they'd graduated from Chamberlain Junior High. Carrie was taking the commercial business courses. Sue, of course, was in the college division. She thought herself suddenly loathsome. She found she could not bear that, and so she twisted it at him. When did you start making all these big moral decisions? After you started fucking me? She saw the good humor fade from his face and was sorry. Guess I should have kept quiet, he said, and pulled up his pants. It's not you, it's me. She put a hand on his arm. I'm ashamed, see? I know, he said, but I shouldn't be giving advice. I'm not very good at it. Tommy, do you ever hate being so, well, popular? Me? The question wrote surprise on his face. Do you mean like football and class president and that stuff? Yes. No, it's not very important. High school isn't a very important place. When you're going, you think it's a big deal, but when it's over, nobody really thinks it was great, unless they're beard up. That's how my brother and his buddies are, anyway. It did not soothe her. It made her fears worse. Little Susie Mix and Match from UN High School, head cupcake of the entire cupcake brigade. Prom gown kept forever in the closet, wrapped in protective plastic. The night pressed dark against the slightly steamed car windows. I'll probably end up working at my dad's car lot, he said. I'll spend my Friday and Saturday nights down at Uncle Billy's or out at the Cavalier drinking beer and talking about the Saturday afternoon I got that fat pitch from Saunders and we upset Dorchester. Get married to some nagging broad and always own last year's model. Vote Democrat? Don't, she said, her mouth suddenly full of a dark, sweet horror. She pulled him to her. Love me. My head is so bad tonight. Love me. Love me. So he loved her, and this time it was different. This time there finally seemed to be room, and there was no tiresome rubbing, but a delicious friction that went up and up. Twice he had to stop, panting, and held himself back, and then he went again. He was a virgin before me and admitted it, I would have believed a lie. And went hard, and her breath came in short, digging gasps. And then she began to yell and hold at his back, helpless to stop, sweating, the bad taste washed away, every cell seeming to have its own climax, body filled with sunlight, musical notes in her mind, butterflies behind her skull, in the cage of her mind. Later on the way home, he asked her formally if she would go to the spring ball with him. She said she would. He asked her if she had decided what to do about Carrie. She said she hadn't. He said that it made no difference, but she thought that it did. It had begun to seem that it meant all the difference. From Telekinesis, Analysis and Aftermath, Science Yearbook, 1981, by Dean D. L. McGuffin. There are, of course, still these scientists today, regretfully, the Duke University people are in their forefront, who reject the terrific underlying implications of the Carrie White affair, like the Flatland Society, the Rosicrucians, or the Corallies of Arizona, who are positive that the atomic bomb does not work. These unfortunates are flying in the face of logic with their heads in the sand, and beg your pardon for the mixed metaphor. Of course, one is able to understand the consternation, the raised voices, the angry letters and arguments at scientific convocations. The idea of telekinesis itself has been a bitter pill for the scientific community to swallow, with its horror movie trappings of Ouija boards and mediums and table rappings and floating coronets. But understanding will still not excuse scientific irresponsibility. The outcome of the White affair raises grave and difficult questions. An earthquake has struck our ordered notions of the way the natural world is supposed to act and react. Can you blame even such a renowned physicist as Gérald Lupponet for claiming the whole thing is a hoax and a fraud? Even in the face of such overwhelming evidence as the White Commission presented? For if Carrie White is the truth, then what of Newton? They sat in the living room, Carrie and Mama, listening to Tennessee Ernie Ford singing "Let the Lower Lights Be Burning" on a Webcore phonograph, which Mama called the Victrola, or, if in a particularly good mood, the Vic. Carrie sat at the sewing machine, pumping with her feet as she sewed the sleeves on a new dress. Mama sat beneath the plaster crucifix, tatting doilies and bumping her feet in time to the song, which was one of her favorites. Mr. P.P. Bliss, who had written this hymn, and others seemingly without number, was one of Mama's shining examples of God at work upon the face of the earth. He had been a sailor and a sinner, two terms that were synonymous in Mama's lexicon. A great blasphemer, a laugher in the face of the Almighty. Then a great storm had come up at sea. The boat had threatened to capsize, and Mr. P.P. Bliss had gotten down on his sin-sickly knees with a vision of hell yawning beneath the ocean floor to receive him, and he had prayed to God. Mr. P.P. Bliss promised God that if he saved him, he would dedicate the rest of his life to him. The storm, of course, had cleared immediately. Brightly beams our Father's mercy from his lighthouse evermore, but to us he gives the keeping of the lights along the shore. All of Mr. P.P. Bliss's hymns had a sea-going flavor to them. The dress she was sewing was actually quite pretty, a dark wine color, the closest Mama would allow her to red, and the sleeves were puffed. She tried to keep her mind strictly on her sewing, but of course it wandered. The overhead light was strong and harsh and yellow. The small, dusty plush sofa was, of course, deserted. Carrie had never had a boy in to sit. And on the far wall was a twin shadow, the crucified Jesus, and beneath him, Mama. The school had called Mama at the laundry, and she had come home at noon. Carrie had watched her come up the walk, and her belly trembled. Mama was a very big woman, and she always wore a hat. Lately, her legs had begun to swell, and her feet always seemed on the point of overflowing her shoes. She wore a black cloth coat with a black fur collar. Her eyes were blue and magnified behind rimless bifocals. She always carried a large black satchel purse, and in it was her change purse, her billfold, both black, a large King James Bible, also black, with her name stamped on the front in gold, and a stack of tracts secured with a rubber band. The tracts were usually orange and smearily printed. Carrie knew vaguely that Mama and Daddy Ralph had been Baptists once, but had left the church when they became convinced that the Baptists were doing the work of the Antichrist. Since that time, all worship had taken place at home. Mama held worship on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Fridays. These were called holy days. Mama was the minister, Carrie the congregation. Services lasted from 2 to 3 hours. Mama had opened the door and walked stolidly in. She and Carrie had stared at each other down the short length of the front hall for a moment, like gunfighters before a shootout. It was one of those brief moments that seem, fear, could it really have been fear in Mama's eyes? Much longer in retrospect. Mama closed the door behind her. "You're a woman," she said softly. Carrie felt her face twisting and crumpling and could not help it. "Why didn't you tell me?" she cried. "Oh, Mama, I was so scared, and the girls all made fun and threw things, and..." Mama had been walking toward her, and now her hand flashed with sudden limber speed. A hard hand, laundry calloused and muscled. It struck her backhand across the jaw, and Carrie fell down in the doorway between the hall and the living room, weeping loudly. "And God made Eve from the rib of Adam," Mama said. Her eyes were very large in the rimless glasses. They looked like poached eggs. She thumped Carrie with the side of her foot, and Carrie screamed, "Get up, woman! Let's us get in and pray. Let's us pray to Jesus for our woman weak, wicked, sinning souls. Mama!" The sobs were too strong to allow more. The latent hysterics had come out grinning and gibbering. She could not stand up. She could only crawl into the living room with her hair hanging in her face, braying huge, hoarse sobs. Every now and again, Mama would swing her foot. So they progressed across the living room toward the place of the altar, which had once been a small bedroom. "And Eve was weak, and..." "Say it, woman! Say it!"
"No, Mama, please help me."
The foot swung. Carrie screamed.
"And Eve was weak and loosed the raven on the world," Mama continued. "And the raven was called sin, and the first sin was intercourse. And the Lord visited Eve with a curse, and the curse was the curse of blood. And Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden and into the world, and Eve found that her belly had grown big with child." The foot swung and connected with Carrie's rump. Her nose scraped the wood floor. They were entering the place of the altar. There was a cross on a table covered with an embroidered silk cloth. On either side of the cross there were white candles. Behind this were several paint-by-the-numbers of Jesus and his apostles. To the right was the worst place of all, the home of terror, the cave where all hope, all resistance, will, and Mama's was extinguished. The closet door leered open. Inside, below a hideous blue bulb, lit, was DeRose's conception of Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." And there was a second curse, and the curse of childbearing, and Eve brought forth Cain in sweat and blood. Now Mama dragged her, half crawling, down to the altar, where they both fell on their knees. Mama gripped Carrie's wrist tightly. And following Cain, Eve gave birth to Abel, having not yet repented of the sin of intercourse. And so the Lord visited Eve with a third curse, and this was the curse of murder. Cain rose up and slew Abel with a rock, and still Eve did not repent, nor all the daughters of Eve. And upon Eve did the crafty serpent found a kingdom of whoredoms and pestilences.
"Mama," she shrieked, "Mama, please listen. It wasn't my fault."
"Bow your head," Mama said. "Let's us pray."
"You should have told me."
Mama brought her hand down on the back of Carrie's neck, and behind it was all the heavy muscle developed by 11 years of slinging heavy laundry bags and trucking piles of wet sheets. Carrie's eye-bulging face jerked forward, and her forehead smacked the altar, leaving a mark and making the candles tremble. "Let's us pray," Mama said softly, implacably. Weeping and snuffling, Carrie bowed her head. A runner of snot hung pendulously from her nose, and she wiped it away. "If I had a nickel for every time she made me cry here," with the back of her hand. "Oh, Lord," Mama declaimed hugely, her head thrown back. "Help this sinning woman beside me here see the sin of her days and ways. Show her that if she had remained sinless, the curse of blood never would have come on her. She may have committed the sin of lustful thoughts. She may have been listening to rock and roll music on the radio. She may have been tempted by the Antichrist. Show her that this is your kind, vengeful hand at work, and..."
"No, let me go!"
She tried to struggle to her feet in Mama's hand,
as strong and pitiless as an iron manacle, forced her back to her knees.
"And your sign that she must walk the straight and narrow from here on out if she is to avoid the flaming agonies of the eternal pit. Amen."
She turned her glittering, magnified eyes upon her daughter.
"Go to your closet now."
"No." She felt her breath go thick with terror.
"Go to your closet. Pray in secret. Ask forgiveness for your sin."
"I didn't sin, Mama. You sinned. You didn't tell me. And they laughed." Again she seemed to see a flash of fear in Mama's eyes, gone as quickly and soundlessly as summer lightning. Mama began to force Carrie toward the blue glare of the closet. "Pray to God and your sins may be washed away."
"Mama, you let me go."
"Pray, woman."
"I'll make the stones come again, Mama."
Mama halted. Even her breath seemed to stop in her throat for a moment, and then the hand tightened on her neck, tightened until Carrie saw red, lurid dots in front of her eyes and felt her brain go fuzzy and far off. Mama's magnified eyes swam in front of her.
"You spawn of the devil," she whispered. "Why was I so cursed?"
Carrie's whirling mind strove to find something huge enough to express her agony, shame, terror, hate, fear. It seemed her whole life had narrowed to this miserable, beaten point of rebellion. Her eyes bulged crazily, her mouth, filled with spit, opened wide.
"You suck," she screamed.
Mama hissed like a burned cat. "Sin," she cried. "Oh, sin!" She began to beat Carrie's back, her neck, her head. Carrie was driven reeling into the close blue glare of the closet.
"You fuck!" Carrie screamed.
"There, there, oh, there, it's out. How else do you think she got you? Oh, God, oh, good!" She was whirled into the closet head first, and she struck the far wall and fell on the floor in a semi-daze. The door slammed, and the key turned. She was alone with Mama's angry God. The blue light glared on a picture of a huge and bearded Yahweh who was casting screaming multitudes of humans down through cloudy depths into an abyss of fire. Below them, black, horrid figures struggled through the flames of perdition while the black man sat on a huge flame-colored throne with a trident in one hand. His body was that of a man, but he had a spiked tail and the head of a jackal. She would not break this time. But of course she did break. It took 6 hours, but she broke, weeping and calling Mama to open the door and let her out. The need to urinate was terrible. The black man grinned at her with his jackal mouth, and his scarlet eyes knew all the secrets of woman blood. An hour after Carrie began to call, Mama let her out. Carrie scrabbled madly for the bathroom. It was only now, 3 hours after that, sitting here with her head bowed over the sewing machine like a penitent, that she remembered the fear in Mama's eyes, and she thought she knew the reason why. There had been other times when Mama had kept her in the closet for as long as a day at a stretch. When she stole that 49-cent finger ring from Schubert's 5 and 10, the time she'd found that picture of Flash Bobby Pickett under Carrie's pillow. And Carrie had once fainted from the lack of food and the smell of her own waste. And she had never, never spoken back as she had done today. Today she had even said the F-word. Yet Mama had let her out almost as soon as she broke. There, the dress was done. She removed her feet from the treadle and held it up to look at it. It was long and ugly. She hated it. She knew why Mama had let her out. "Mama, may I go to bed?"
"Yes."
Mama did not look up from her doily. She folded the dress over her arm. She looked down at the sewing machine. All at once the treadle depressed itself. The needle began to dip up and down,
catching the light in steely flashes. The bobbin whirred and jerked. The side wheel spun. Mama's head jerked up, her eyes wide. The looped matrix at the edge of her doily, wonderfully intricate yet at the same time as precise and even, suddenly fell in disarray. "Only clearing the thread," Carrie said softly. "Go to bed," Mama said curtly, and the fear was back in her eyes. "Yes," she was afraid I'd knock the closet door right off its hinges, "Mama." "And I think I could. From The Shadow Exploded, page 58. Margaret White was born and raised in Motton, a small town which borders Chamberlain and sends its tuition students to Chamberlain's junior and senior high schools. Her parents were fairly well-to-do. They owned a prosperous night spot just outside the Motton town limits called the Jolly Roadhouse. Margaret's father, John Brigham, was killed in a barroom shooting incident in the summer of 1959. Margaret Brigham, who was then almost 30, began attending fundamentalist prayer meetings. Her mother had become involved with a new man, Harold Allison, whom she later married, and they both wanted Margaret out of the house. She believed her mother, Judith, and Harold Allison were living in sin and made her views known frequently. Judith Brigham expected her daughter to remain a spinster the rest of her life. In the more pungent phraseology of her soon-to-be stepfather, Margaret had a face like the ass end of a gasoline truck and a body to match. He also referred to her as a little praying Jesus. Margaret refused to leave until 1960, when she met Ralph White at a revival meeting. In September of that year, she left the Brigham residence in Motton and moved to a small flat in Chamberlain Center. The courtship of Margaret Brigham and Ralph White terminated in marriage on March 23, 1962. On April 3, 1962, Margaret White was admitted briefly to Westover Doctor's Hospital. "Nope, she wouldn't tell us what was wrong," Harold Allison said. "The one time we went to see her, she told us we were living in adultery even though we were hitched, and we were going to hell. She said God had put an invisible mark on our foreheads, but she could see it. Acted crazy as a bat in a hen house, she did. Her mom tried to be nice, tried to find out what the matter with her was. She got hysterical and started to rave about an angel with a sword who'd walk through the parking lots of roadhouses and cut down the wicked. We left." Judith Allison, however, had at least an idea of what might have been wrong with her daughter. She thought that Margaret had gone through a miscarriage. If so, the baby was conceived out of wedlock. Confirmation of this would shed an interesting light on the character of Carrie's mother. In a long and rather hysterical letter to her mother dated August 19, 1962, Margaret said that she and Ralph were living sinlessly without the curse of intercourse. She urged Harold and Judith Allison to close their abode of wickedness and do likewise. "It is," Margaret declares near the end of her letter, "the only way you and that man can avoid the rain of blood yet to come. Ralph and I, like Mary and Joseph, will neither know or pollute each other's flesh. If there is issue, let it be divine." Of course, the calendar tells us that Carrie was conceived later that same year. The girls dressed quietly for their Monday morning Period 1 gym class, with no horseplay or little screaming catcalls. And none of them were very surprised when Miss Desjardins slammed open the locker room door and walked in. Her silver whistle dangled between her small breasts, and if her shorts were the ones she'd been wearing on Friday, no trace of Carrie's bloody handprint remained. The girls continued to dress sullenly, not looking at her. "Aren't you the bunch to send out for graduation?" Miss Desjardins said softly. "When is it, a month? And the spring ball even less than that. Most of you have your dates and gowns already, I bet. Sue, you'll be going with Tommy Ross. Helen, Roy Everts. Oh, Chris, I imagine that you can take your pick. Who's the lucky guy?" "Billy Nolan," Chris Hargensen said sullenly. Well, isn't he the lucky one? Disjardin remarked. What are you going to give him for a party favor, Chris? A bloody Kotex? Or how about some used toilet paper? I understand these things seem to be your sack.